we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatments of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Show, Western Canada's only radio program focusing on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Co-op Radio, Vancouver, Canada. Today is Friday, March the 10th. I'm your host, Jen Dobell, for the next hour, and I'm joined in studio by my co-host, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
So today we have two feature interviews. We'll begin by speaking with an award-winning Canadian filmmaker, Liz Marshall, about her latest film, Meat the Future, which explores the future of meat, lab-grown meat. After that, we will speak with the local animal rights activist David Isbister on last night's epic victory for cetaceans at the Vancouver Park Board meeting. I was in attendance and it was truly a huge celebration. The room erupted with cheers and we sang Baby Beluga in the Deep Blue Sea and headed to the pub for celebratory beers.
I can't wait to hear about that.
That's fantastic.
I saw stuff, lots of stuff on Facebook and I'm excited to
Very
find out.
Very exciting day, yes. Our much-loved, award-winning Canadian filmmaker Liz Marshall has brought us eye-opening and transformational films such as The Ghosts in Our Machine and Water on the Table. In keeping with the theme of animal rights and environmental films, Liz is currently working on her latest documentary, which explores the future of clean meat. Meat the Future is a feature-length documentary showcasing Memphis Meat CEO, cardiologist Dr. Uma Valetti, and his team of innovators who are leading the way to a more compassionate, earth-friendly, safe, and healthy alternative to the current meat production that we have right now. And let's tune in right now for the interview with Liz Marshall.
Thanks for being here today, Liz.
Good to be here.
So you're well known in the social justice community for your documentaries, which shed light on some very crucial topics, environmentalism, animal rights, water use. And now you're working on a film called Meat the Future, spelled M-E-A-T, as in the meat that we eat. Can you tell us about that film?
Yeah, sure. So Meat the Future actually has a website, mtffilm.com. So you can check it out there. We've got a demo. We've got, you know, info about the team and what the film's about. But essentially, the film is at the development phase right now, I would say late development. So really, for the last year, I've been researching and doing some pretty extensive research and some shooting with the film's main subjects, which are all based in America, Silicon Valley specifically. So it's a startup story, but it's also greater than a bigger than a startup story. It's really exploring the advent of what's referred to as cultured meat, and really, you know, that could be like the next food revolution. And so cultured meat is meat that is grown in a lab, in a controlled environment. And I can talk more about that if you like. I'm not a science nerd, but, and it's not a science film. It's a character-driven film that is following the incredible possibilities and challenges of this new industry.
And as a vegan, what are your personal feelings about lab-grown meat?
Well, I'm ethically motivated to make this film, to explore this subject matter. Because it's meat without slaughter. And the movers and shakers behind this movement are also often, not always, ethically motivated as well. So if cultured meat becomes the new paradigm, then it means that conventional big egg, conventional, you know, meat that people are buying in the grocery store and eating in restaurants, it means that that would be replaced with this new technology, which means that factory farming, which has become this global, perverse, out of control system, would be replaced with food technology. I that think, does not require any animals, slaughter or, you know, breeding and using animals the way that we do now in the world.
And the land use and water use as well is a problem that many people are becoming more aware of in the production of their food.
Exactly. So the environmental climate perspective on this is also really exciting. I really see this film bridging the gap between the environmental movement and the animal protection movement. And I think that really motivates me as well, because I do think after having made The Ghosts in Our Machine, that and also Water on the Table before that, which is an environmental film, and The Ghosts in Our Machine is an animal rights film, I think that there is an unfortunate chasm between these two movements, and I hope that Meet the Future is able to really bring those together.
I love the idea, and I do think it's the solution, because as someone who's been doing animal rights advocacy for a couple of years myself, I know there are certain people that just will not give up their meat, and all I care about is giving up the cruelty. So this is definitely an interesting option. And in the making of your film, when you were speaking with the people who own the company who were doing it, what are they saying about how long it will be before this is something that's affordable and readily available?
Yeah, well, interesting question. So some of that is, you know, hypothetical. But, you know, they have business analysts and experts that are working on this, and scientists and researchers, and, you know, the development process is really, really interesting. And we have exclusive access behind the scenes to be able to document the process and the development of cultured meat with Memphis Meats. That's the name of the company that we're following in the film. And they're based in Silicon Valley. So, you know, they're basically sort of claiming the consumer market space right now and saying that they will be on the market in 4 to 5 years. So that's a really interesting possibility. And of course, there's huge challenges to that, like, you know, scale, affordability, consumer awareness and interest in the product. Those are all dimensions and angles of the story.
So speaking of that, did you talk to anyone that works there who's done a little bit of outreach in the community maybe to find out if people would actually buy this meat?
Oh yeah, I mean, that's something that they're working on all the time. And another featured storyline and character person in the film is Bruce Friedrich, who is a very well-known and very effective person in the animal protection movement in the U.S. He used to be the vice president of PETA. He was with Farm Sanctuary. He's an amazing activist. And he's now the executive director of the Good Food Institute. Mm-hmm. And the Good Food Institute is working very hard in America and abroad to lobby and support this movement.
That's great. I see it as hopefully a stepping stone, though, to getting people off meat in the end. I want to know what you think about the health aspect. So a lot of people are saying that the lab-grown meat will be healthier because there won't be a need for the antibiotics and there won't be the ingestion of pesticides through the fat of the meat, which is where the pesticides are currently stored in animals that we then consume. Have you spoken to anybody about the difference in the health aspects of lab meat versus how we're currently getting it from factory farms?
Yeah, so the CEO of Memphis Meats, his name is Uma Valetti. He's actually a cardiologist, and he was with the Mayo Clinic. So he is really an expert on cardiovascular health and has said that cultured meat, which is, by the way, also referred to as clean meat, that it is definitely going to be, you know, healthier for people to consume without fecal matter, without hormones, antibiotics, torture.
Right. And like you said, the fecal matter issue, there will be no risk of E. coli and bird flu and a number of other issues that we have to be concerned about that cause us to sometimes turn on the news and see that there's a massive meat recall. That will be a thing of the past. So that's safer for sure.
Yeah, so it covers that issue as well. I mean, you know, when I first started developing this concept, I was interested in the broader, bigger kind of question and issue of alternatives, period, to conventional agriculture and meat consumption. But there's other films being done right now, and What the Health is just being released. That's by the filmmakers of Cowspiracy that are working. So there's other films in the works about vegan, plant-based alternatives. So, you know, it's important when you make a film that you're really laser focused on what your thesis is, what your subject and focus is. And I am the kind of filmmaker that likes to zero in on people that are making a difference, and that through those people, through those, so that's actually in film language, it's referred to as character driven filmmaking. So like, for instance, with The Ghost in Our Machine, I followed Joanne MacArthur, animal rights photographer, over the course of a year as she did her work with We Animals, her weanimals.org, her amazing project. So with this, I'm following two main subjects, Uma Valetti and Bruce Friedrich, because they're really at the forefront. They're the pioneers that are movers and shakers within this new movement, this food revolution. So it's like access to the vanguard of this, you know, what could be, you know, a new industry that takes over big agriculture. So for me, it's important that I'm really laser focused in terms of what it is I'm following and trying to articulate and trying to explore in a feature length documentary. So rather than, you know, focusing on an array of different, you know, protein and plant-based and, you know, meat-based alternatives, I chose to really zero in on lab-grown. They actually don't like to call it lab-grown. They like to refer to it as cultured meat or clean meat. So anyways, I'm rambling, but...
No, you're not. I think that's really interesting. And is the reason that you decided to focus on that instead of a lot of companies that are making, for example, pea protein-based meat imitation products, which do taste identical to what they're trying to create, what they're trying to imitate? Is the reason that you chose this over that because you, like myself, are aware that there are certain people that just will not get off the meat?
Exactly.
So as an activist, that was more strategic for you.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've become more pragmatic than I think I was before. After making The Ghosts in Our Machine and traveling the world with it, I went to 60 cities around the globe. It was, you know, really an honor and a privilege to, be at sort of on the ground as part of this incredible social movement, the animal rights movement. It was awesome. And but, you know, I am overwhelmingly sort of conscious of the fact, and this is my perspective, that, you know, the vast majority of people are still eating meat. And of those people, most of them are eating factory farmed meat. So, you know, The Ghost in Our Machine is a consciousness raising film. It removes people's blinders to really see the animals that are invisible around us through the different animal industries. I wanted my next film to be solutions focused. And it's solutions focused because it's following solutions focused people. Whereas Joanne MacArthur in The Ghost in Our Machine, what she's doing is so consciousness raising. She's, through her lens as a photographer, she's inviting people to see animals as sentient beings. What we're trying to do with Meet the Future is show, okay, here's some people, you know, they're also activists, they're, you know, movers and shakers, working overtime to make a difference. in a different kind of way.
Yeah, and you know, I just want to say I really love Joanne MacArthur's work, and if I can't get someone to watch the film, because, you know, there's people that go, oh, is it one of those slaughterhouse films or something like that, I'm not going to watch it, I'll just send them her website, and her still photography will still bring tears to your eyes, especially the image of the newborn baby calf in a wheelbarrow that is being taken from its mother to a veal hutch. And thank you so much for making that film and highlighting her work.
Yeah, well, I mean, The Ghost in Our Machine is a gentle film about a very tough subject.
Mm-hmm. It was offset with Farm Sanctuary Happiness, for sure, that helped.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's also, I mean, all of that was really, those were conscious choices not to show too many violent images, although it's very haunting because it's suggested all the way through, because of course these industries are all very violent and, inhumane. Mm-hmm. So there's other, like Earthlings, of course, is an incredible film for what it is. And The Ghost in Our Machine is kind of having the same message as Earthlings, but in a very, very different kind of way.
You're right. Not so violent, but, you know, the images of those pigs and the animals, or the animals in the fur farms that I know you couldn't rescue. It must have been really difficult to be there to only document and not to steal them and give them a better life. And you couldn't, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, really challenging, speaking of haunting, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about your career as a filmmaker. I want to inspire activists out there who are at the point now in their activism that they don't want to work the regular jobs anymore. They want to spend all of their time fighting for animals and get their paycheck in that way. So let's talk about things that you wish you had known sooner about filmmaking and the path that you took and how maybe it could have been easier, or what you've learned.
Well, okay. So, I mean, first of all, the first thing, I mean, I think it's like so inspiring, all the amazing animal rights activists out there who inspire me and have educated me so much, always. So, you know, for example, in The Ghost in Our Machine, we follow, there's a scene with Toronto Pig Save. And that Save, Toronto Pig Save, turned into the Save movement and has just had this ripple effect all over the globe.
It has been huge.
Yeah, and yeah. Bearing witness to, animals en route to slaughter is a profound movement, and at the grassroots level. So there's so much, and that's just one example, obviously. There's so many ways that people can get involved to make a difference in the world. And I choose filmmaking. That's my vehicle. Those are my tools. That's my toolkit, my arsenal, my voice. And I'm interested in all different kinds of social justice issues. I've made human rights films, environmental films, and then animal films. So I'm interested in the whole spectrum of people that are working overtime to make a difference in the world. I really find inspiration and hope in following inspirational stories like that. I don't create doom and gloom films. I create films that can shed light and give energy and positivity and help motivate people. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. And then to answer your question about career stuff as a filmmaker, well, as a documentary filmmaker, I mean, you have to be really, truly obsessed to get a project off the ground. And that is really the secret recipe, is not whether your idea is good enough or, you know, it's really whether you are determined enough. Whether you have that tenacious, passionate ability to make things happen. That's how a documentary gets off the ground. And of course, having a good idea and the timing of something is also very, very important. I think using The Ghost in Our Machine as an example again, I think the timing of that film just couldn't have been better. It was released in 2013. And that is when I think, I mean, I've heard it reflected back to us many times. That's really when things, that was on the heels of Blackfish. It was the same year that Speciesism was also released. And there's just been a real movement that just keeps expanding in the mainstream. So I'm interested in making films that can hopefully reach a wide and broad audience and not film. I don't want to spend years making a film and then that film is only seen by, you know, people that already know about the subject or already care. I'm really interested in working within the film industry to get funded and then to try to get that film out into the world at large. So with Meet the Future, we'll take a similar trajectory path in, you know, with distribution and with, you know, audience engagement. Yeah, and film festivals and broadcasters and stuff like that. So,
well, you're quite famous now in the filmmaking community, so I wouldn't think this would be too challenging.
I don't know if I'm famous, but...
You are in our community.
Okay.
Well, yes.
That's cool.
But has it been really difficult to make a living from this career, even being as talented as you are?
Well, first of all, thanks for your compliments. I would say... You know, I've been making films. That's all I've been doing, actually, since I, you know, I went to film school in the mid-90s. I went to Ryerson in Toronto, where I live. And I've just been working nonstop, meaning it doesn't mean that I always have a gig. It means that it's all I do, though, working in film and television as a documentary filmmaker. So either as a director, I've also in the past worked as a cinematographer and, you know, yeah, I try to keep one foot always in the TV world while I'm directing and producing my feature length films.
That's smart.
Right? Like right now I'm working with Vice on a series.
Yeah.
And documentary, of course. I don't work in narrative fiction, although I admire fiction stuff. And then, you know, I'm also finishing up right now another feature length documentary. And then I'm at the beginning stages. Hopefully I'll be in production with Meet the Future in the near future.
That's awesome. And speaking of that, do you want to announce when you think that will be coming out?
Yeah. So the hope for Meet the Future is to release it. Our goal is to release the film in early 2019.
Great. And Memphis, it's Memphis Meats, did you say, was the name of the company that you follow in the film?
Yep. And then also the Good Food Institute as well.
Right. Do you feel that Memphis Meats is one of the biggest companies taking on this issue at the moment?
Yeah.
Is that why you selected them?
They're really amazing, the work that they're doing. Like, they're right on the cutting edge at the front. Yeah.
And I'm curious, are they vegans?
Some of them are. Not all of them.
That's interesting.
It's important, I think, to the ethos of the company that they represent diversity, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That, yeah. But a lot of people, most people eat meat. I think this is something that has, sometimes I feel concerned. I don't know. This is, again, my perspective. But sometimes in the vegan community, there's a perspective that the whole world must go vegan right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the message. I understand the ethics. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm vegan myself, obviously. But it's not realistic.
Right.
So as a filmmaker, that's another reason I chose to focus on this topic. Because from my perspective, if this is something that is doable, tangible, tactile in our lifetime, to get the conventional animal agriculture to change it so that it actually becomes something completely different.
And humane.
Yeah, although that word can be used in so many different ways, right?
Okay.
Humane meat and things
right,
like that, right?
Right? Yeah.
No,
yeah,
but I mean slaughter free.
Way.
Slaughter free.
Right. So
slaughter
that's
free.
What I mean. Yeah.
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 If that actually, I think that it could happen.
Yeah.
Like I really truly.
I do too.
Yeah. That's why I'm focused on this film, because I believe that it's something that will happen.
That's awesome. I'm really glad you're doing it. And it sounds like your film coming out will correspond just a little bit earlier than their expected date of having this into production.
Exactly.
So that's perfect timing. Well, we're just running out of time here. I just want to give you an opportunity to let our listeners know where they can find out about your work. And if are you taking funding from anyone, if there's someone listening today who's interested in helping you out there?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, I mean... you know, being a filmmaker, like, you're always hustling to get funded, right?
Yeah.
And so right now, the documentary channel, Canada's documentary channel, has come on board for development, which is wonderful. Because with a broadcaster, what it means is that other pots of money open up. And so the hope is that they will also come on board for production. These are all sort of technical, whatever terms of, you know, how you classify the phase that you're at with making a film, because it's such an epic journey to make a film,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So some films, like I know Cowspiracy, for example, those are friends of mine too. I know that they did, you know, exceptionally well in terms of their audience engagement campaign.
Yeah.
I believe, although I could be wrong, I think that they were fully financed through crowdsourcing.
Okay. Didn't Leonardo DiCaprio have something to do with that?
Yeah, well, he was part of the Netflix recut. So they got an acquisition with Netflix after the film was made. And that was amazing for them. So anyways, back to Canada. We have a different system here for financing than in America for documentaries. And so that's the system that I like to try to tap into. So I'm grateful that the documentary channel is on board right now.
Okay. So, again, where can the public find out about you? And if there's any really wealthy, wonderful people out there today that are listening that want to give you money.
Yeah, that they want to contribute and help out, that would be amazing. Well, if any of them are American, we do have a fiscal sponsor, which means that if American investors or wealthy donors want to give to the film, then they will receive a tax receipt. So it's a nice incentive. Here in Canada, yes. I mean, it would be wonderful. Yep. Anyways, I can be reached through my website. And there's three websites I'm going to mention for your listeners. There's my website, lizmars.com, LIZMARS.com. That's my website, my company. And then Meet the Future is mtffilm.com. That's all about Meet the Future film. And you can watch our demo there and more stuff. And then there's The Ghosts in Our Machine, which is theghostsinourmachine.com. And that is a really extensive website, magazine-style format. And you can learn all about the film, which we started developing in 2011. And it was released in 2013.
And it's really interesting. Yeah, I would recommend watching that for sure. And also checking out Joanne MacArthur's website. Okay, well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Liz.
Hey, and thanks a lot for having me.
You're off to a fun party with Anna Pippis now, so enjoy yourself.
Okay, thanks.
Sure, there'll be great food.
Good to see you. Okay,
thanks, bye.
Ciao.
So I've got some upcoming events for everyone. Lots of food stuff here. And we're featuring Vancouver Meatless Meetup today. So if you remember a couple weeks ago, we spoke about Loopy Cafe. They are a zero waste community endeavor. The food is sourced from grocery stores, produce markets, and farms utilizing items which would otherwise be thrown out, often because they are thought to not be presentable due to age or abnormal shape or simply because of fast inventory turnover. Now, I'm all for using food that can't be sold in stores, even though it's perfectly good. And that's what you can get at this cafe. So Vancouver Meatless Meetup is having, again, we have these monthly lunches there. And the next one, so it's $5 all in. The next one is Sunday, March the 19th. All you can eat lunch. The food is whatever they happen to have donated that day. And the lunch takes place between 11:30 and 1:30 p.m. It's in the Champlain Heights area, and it's $5. Bring an appetite, good conversation. These events always sell out, so make sure that you RSVP ASAP at Meatless. It'll be meetup.com/meatlessmeetup, and that's MEATLESS. So more food. Have you ever had Burmese food?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, neither have I. I really wanted to go to this event. I have to work this night, though. This is happening Wednesday, March the 22nd. It's a Burmese restaurant called Laksa King, which is located at 25 46 East Hastings in Vancouver. So For those of you who have not tried Burmese food, you're in for something completely different. Burma's food is a fusion reflected by its geographic location between Thailand, China, and India, but with a spicy twist. This sounds really good.
That does sound really good. Yeah. Anything from that region is delicious.
Yeah, so I was looking at the menu here for this dinner. Again, Meatless Meetup is putting on, and it's got a dish called Onnoi Kal Soup. Probably saying that wrong. It's a traditional thick, spicy coconut curry soup with bean curd puffs. It has a sweet taste of coconut balanced by a hot, spicy curry. There is paratha bread, which is originally from India. It's a multi-layered golden flatbread.
I had that for breakfast today.
Oh, man. That's a treat. That's heavenly.
Straight to the arteries, that one.
Eggplant. Oh, but it's vegan. This one's not so bad for you. It won't clog your cholesterols. Eggplant basil, which is stir-fried eggplant with house-made soy sauce laden with a fresh basil. And then they're ending with a Burmese tago pudding. So this is $19 cash, including tax and tip. And this happens on Wednesday, March the 2nd at 6:15. Again, if you want to RSVP, go to meetup.com/meatlessmeetup. And do we have time for like one more?
Yes, but okay. I just want to say I'm always working during all the good stuff.
Thanks for letting us know. I know, me too. We need to have some of these events on weekends, which we do sometimes. So here's one coming up on a Friday. You're free on Fridays.
Mm-hmm.
And you know about Vicenta Molina, right? She's a very well-known nutritionist. There's a picture of you that I posted online with her. Remember that?
Yes, at the Dairy Free Living event. Yeah, I got a good hug from her.
So Vicenta Molina is a local dietitian who's plant-based, and she advocates a plant-based diet. She's written many books, Becoming Vegan, Becoming Vegetarian, Becoming Raw, and many others. And she is an authority on plant-based diets. So she lives in the Vancouver co-housing, which is an intentional co-housing community. And we have events at her where she lives every month in their community rooms. So
Nick Waller lives there.
Oh, cool. Yes. Then he should go to this event. So on Friday, March the 31st, we're hosting a talk on vegan nutrition by Vicento.
I want to go.
The co-hosting.
Awesome.
Okay, well, you better RSVP again, because these events, they sell out. Not that you don't have to, all you have to pay is it's a potluck dish, like a snack.
That's
snack
awesome.
Luck. Bring a snack. So this is a really, it says $10 here too. Sorry about that. So there's going to be a talk by her and then a discussion. And actually, this one isn't a potluck. So yeah, it's just the 10 bucks. So that's again happening on Friday, March the 31st. 7:15 p.m. And make sure you sign up like sooner than later at Meatless Meetup on meetup.com. So if you have any animal related events that you would like to have played or announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can put it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And once again, you are listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio here on 100.5 FM in Vancouver, Canada. And now we have some news.
Yeah, big news, actually. Last night at a special meeting at the Vancouver Park Board, they voted unanimously to bring forward a bylaw change by May 2017, which is just around the corner, prohibiting importation and display of cetaceans at the Vancouver Aquarium. Before the construction of the aquarium's $110 million tank expansion, which was scheduled to begin in the fall of 2017, almost all Park Board commissioners acknowledge that it's unnecessary to keep cetaceans in captivity for aquariums to thrive and function, and express desire to see the aquarium adapt to change, moving towards a future without captive whales and dolphins. And the room erupted with cheers.
I can't even believe it. Do you realize, like, I attended one of the original park board meetings, I don't know how many years ago, 10, when this was up for, again, debate to actually put a public plebiscite out. Now, I thought that was going to be one of the options, was to put that out, but you're saying
yes.
No.
So there were four possible outcomes that the board considered when addressing the issue of cetaceans in captivity at the aquarium, and they are: one, call on the city council to include a plebiscite in the 2018 municipal election; two, accept the Vancouver Aquarium's February 20th, 2017 announcement on plans to expand the tanks and bring in more belugas that they have on loan to SeaWorld. And by the way, they would be put on a plane. I don't think that's
so
humane.
Stressful.
Yeah, ridiculous.
That's how they always move them.
They do. It's just most horrible. People don't know this.
It's just one of the horrible parts of keeping cetaceans in captivity. I've seen pictures of that. It looks disgusting.
So number three was to amend the Parks Board control, the Parks Control bylaws, which is the one that won. And number four was to maintain the status quo. And when the one of the commissioners was reading out these four options, he had to keep asking the audience to keep quiet, because when he announced number three, which is what we wanted, the room erupted. it again.
A little bit of a biased perspective.
Well, I would say half the people in the crowd were from the aquarium and wearing their uniforms as well. So there was a lot of tension. And let's just talk about a funny story speaking to that tension. My friend Jeff Regeer was sitting next to me. And he and I are activists. We're at the aquarium quite a lot. And peacefully, of course, and respectfully. And he was holding my phone for me to get a better angle on the commissioners when they were speaking. And when one of the commissioners was comparing what's going on at the aquarium to past historical atrocities that we no longer tolerate, he turned his phone around to film John Nightingale, who was sitting behind us. And John Nightingale stood up and tried to violently grab the phone from his hands.
Why?
And it was quite a scene. And
it's obviously going to show up online somewhere. Why would he do that?
I couldn't stop
He's
laughing.
He's the leader of the
It was a real
aquarium.
Scene. Everybody was yelling, call security, and we had to settle down finally and get back to the meeting. Anyway, so 65 people signed up to speak at the special park board meeting. At first, the park board staff did a long presentation, and then the Vancouver Aquarium did one. Afterwards, delegations had 5 minutes to speak with the American Humane Society and the Vancouver Humane Society representatives. And what was interesting here was that the two representatives had very differing approaches, and it's known to be that the American Humane Society often does support industries that hold animals captive. So right. Their name is a bit misleading and nothing like our Vancouver Humane Society, which truly does advocate for the freedom of animals. Mm-hmm. So let's see here. So let's just talk some bullet points. The Vancouver Aquarium claimed that they needed 10 more years of belugas for research, and most of us see past that and know that it's more about profit, because only one scientific paper on belugas has been produced by the aquarium in the past 4 decades of keeping belugas in captivity. We've also heard from many experts, such as scientists locally here, who have said that there is not much valid research coming out of animals that are kept in captivity, and they oppose animals being in captivity. And to this, John Nightingale has publicly said that he thinks people who feel this way have no credibility, and he's speaking to his fellow scientists when he says this, which I find quite laughable. Wow. So I could go on. We've got a few more points here if you're interested in hearing how everything went.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at some live Facebook posts. So this happened over a course of the last 2 nights, actually. There were so many speakers, 65 speakers who were going to be given 5 minutes each. But then they also were able to have the commissioners ask them questions. So obviously it went over the first night. That was Wednesday, and it was to be continued last night, and then the news broke out on Facebook. I was on there when I got home from work. I saw it, and I got an email from No Whales in Captivity, Annalise Sorg, there saying, we won. I'm like, what?
I've never
how could this happen?
I've never seen my fellow activists so happy.
I know. It feels like we just so rarely get victories for the animals, and we work so hard.
Especially being such a small group, using our own money and our own time. It does cost money to get a message out.
And you know what? The aquarium says, oh, this is only being brought out as an issue because of a small group of very vocal activists. Like, that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
It's not.
I know.
It's not. We need to be very vocal about it, because the rest of the world isn't.
And, you know, here's something else that I'm really sick of hearing as far as the people who are in upper management at the aquarium constantly criticizing us in the media. The aquarium claims to be an educational facility that protects our oceans while taking donor money and advertising for oil and gas companies. They're silent about the risks to our coasts from mining development, fracking, LNG terminals and coal ports, virtually all of the industries and mega projects that threaten the health of our oceans, waterways and wildlife. So these same industries have poured tens of millions of dollars of donations into the aquarium in the past few years, and people need to question that.
I think that's a real conflict of interest.
It is, and it's not hard to question that, because when you go to the aquarium, these brands of these mining and oil companies are on the walls of the aquariums and name some of the exhibits even. So how are people unable to see through all of this and to look at the massive amounts of money that they're making? And I just want to point out one more thing here. People often say that the aquarium is nonprofit. They are a private nonprofit. That's a whole different thing. So a private nonprofit does not have to spend a certain percentage of its income on its stated mandate. And in this case, that stated mandate would be research, rescue, conservation, rehabilitation.
And they actually spend a very small portion of their budget on that.
Oh, it's watch the film Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered. You will be absolutely shocked. I've known people that have ripped up their passes after seeing that documentary. And by the way, the filmmaker is not being sued for slander, which indicates that it is all true.
Right. So we have an interview coming up.
We have an interview. So speaking of the theme of the day, which is the big victory, we're going to talk with one of our main, I would call him one of our main activists simply because he spends so much time organizing these events, and he shows up to these events at the aquarium with food for everybody. Of course, he always is very humble and wants to acknowledge everyone else's work, and I will acknowledge their work as well. But today I just want to talk about David because he, in the past couple of months, has created a group called No More Dead Cetaceans and has got all these people wearing t-shirts for the group coming up to these park board meetings and being really, really persistent. So let's play this interview with David right now.
So today we're speaking with a local Vancouverite, longtime vegan, well-known animal rights activist, David Isbister. He's a personal hero and a huge inspiration of mine. Hi, David.
Hello. Thank you. Washing.
So you created a group called No More Dead Cetaceans and have been working very hard to advocate for the freedom of cetaceans at the Vancouver Aquarium. Can you tell us what your fellow activists have contributed to this recent success, as well as yourself?
Basically, we were able to come together and ask for essentially the same thing, a definitive ban that took definitive action to end captivity of cetaceans. And this, of course, as many people know, was brought on by the deaths of Sheila and Aurora, but it was actually more about the 53-year legacy of cetacean captivity there.
Well, I've personally attended many of your events, and I just want to say how much I appreciate your hard work and dedication to organize rallies and strategically navigate the course to this victory. It just goes to show that a small group of dedicated activists really can create change, even when they're up against powerful, wealthy business owners. And it can be exhausting to advocate for the oppressed. So what advice do you have for others who are in similar battles right now?
Part of our action, I think, there was a sliver of luck in that we managed to reach the right receptive people. I don't always expect that it would get done on a governmental or municipal governmental level. So I think what everyone could do is just be the voice. It's not just my voice in this action that made it successful. I'm just like a tiny, tiny little part of it. I helped organize a few protests, but this has been a growing movement for, easily 20 years, probably 30. And I know there's been people who've been opposed to it since the very, very, very beginning. We heard from a few of the speakers last night, older people who've really put in time. So I think we need to support people who want to speak for those whose voices are ignored, and we need to be those people speaking ourselves.
And I personally want freedom for all the sentient beings held captive at the aquarium. Although I'm grateful for last night's victory, we must now consider the needs and emotions of the octopus, the penguins, the sloths, and many other animals who languish there for human entertainment. And the manta ray touch pool, which I find highly exploitative, is the latest addition to the aquarium. These rays have had their barbs cut off for the safety of humans and are in the most inhumane and depressing tank. And you and I have been at the aquarium together as activists, and we don't want to just talk about the cetaceans in there. We want to talk about people opening their minds to all of the animals who are exploited. And I know that you are an advocate against animals in captivity at the Vancouver Zoo. So what do you want to say to those who patronize these facilities and think that this is the final win, that the cetaceans aren't in there and now it's a humane place?
Now, this is just maybe perhaps one of the templates we could use for other wins in the future. I think that having the public be ignited, there are two sides to it. Having the public be ignited with inspiration over dead belugas is heartening, but I also want to be cautious there because I think it does, like you were kind of alluding to, it sets the tone that maybe this was the final battle and that Vancouver Aquarium will just go about being perfect rescuers and perfect conservationists. But historically, we've seen that isn't the case. And we need to continue to fight for other animals held there. This was just an opportunity provided to us by Kila and Aurora. And I don't say that in a way that is opportunistic. I say it in a way that we absolutely had to respond to that particular species this time, because that was who gave us an opportunity to advocate.
Absolutely. And the commissioners did mention that they were swayed by the recent deaths of Aurora and Kila. So sadly, their death did help with that.
Yeah, and it's a tragic way to have to get a win, but that's part of the embedded focus in my own activism, is that those opportunities, when they present themselves, we can't just allow those institutions to just explain it away with a wave of a hand and, you know, waving at a research paper that they say is beneficial. We have to look deeply at those claims and actually unravel what it is that captivity does for animals, if anything at all.
Right.
In the case of an entertainment or family amusement facility, I still argue, regardless of any research published, which statistically is usually none anyway, it doesn't justify the means.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Kila and Aurora. So, as an activist myself, I can say that I have been villainized by the aquarium's management and staff, and
and
we all know they've been telling people that they suspect that the activists poisoned these animals, which is ridiculous that the ones who are spending their time and money fighting for the freedom of the animals would actually harm them. And, you know, I didn't think the public would believe this, but I have encountered so many people who've personally asked me if we did it.
It was interesting. The last protest, I think I could sense the aquarium was reeling a little bit. We tried to take it easy. We actually do accept that a lot of people who work there genuinely care about animals. It's just that some of their efforts might be being misdirected or reshaped, let's say, by John Nightingale's sort of older concepts, if I'm going to be really polite. So we did hear that people coming out saying, like, well, we know you killed the whale, just randomly, like just random patrons. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, how or where they acquired that information, because I guess in the media, John Nightingale alluded to it and created some innuendo around it. But for them to just walk right out of the aquarium and come right up to us and say, you poisoned the whale, so quit protesting, is odd. I mean, to me, I feel like it's a little desperate on the aquarium's part, but I guess I understand it as well.
From a financial standpoint.
Oh, like from a standpoint where you want to protect your institution and your $350,000 a year job and the $150,000 a year job of all of the other 10 people who make it, and your team of 10 lawyers and all of that sort of stuff, just so you can go on doing your 15% of your operating budget as conservation and rescue.
They really have gone above and beyond to make us look like what we are not. And another example of that is a sign that they have outside the aquarium every weekend when we're there to protest. Yeah. And what does that sign say?
It says, basically, I mean, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it says, due to a planned protest today, there will be a bag check of every individual entering the aquarium to ensure the safety of our animals, guests, and staff. We're bringing in like weapons or poisons or, I mean, and that's an interesting point too, because the aquarium has really been riding this notion that these are unexplained and they just don't know what could possibly be the reason, and this is so unusual. They've been riding that really hard, but the reality is that the last five out of six beluga deaths there are unexplained, and two of them were attributed to shadowy strangers and malicious intent, and none of those things have ever been substantiated. You know, in 2011, with the death of it was a calf. I'm so sorry, I don't have my sheets in front of me, but that's what they said. The calf died, and then one of the staff saw a shadowy stranger lurking by an open back door.
I saw that. That
and
was
so
funny.
Even if that was the case, that's absolutely tragic, and no one should ever do that. I condemn any acts of violence like that against an animal, be they captive or, even if it's not your jurisdiction to do anything like that, we need to advocate. So anyway, I think I lost my train of thought there. But
no, I get it.
Long story short, you know, these are 5 out of 6 unexplained deaths, and blaming it on a shadowy intruder and malicious intent twice with no substantiation is curious to me, at least.
Right, and they're just not acknowledging the fact that animals in captivity simply statistically do not live very long, obviously.
They're doing everything to deny that, actually, yeah. They're doing everything in their power to try to smear our claim that this is an observable reality. So the positioning of two realities, and I still think that even if we're both wrong, like they're on one extreme side and we're on another extreme side, I think even the middle ground of that is unfair to animals and requires advocacy.
Exactly. And speaking of that, do you see there being future protests at the aquarium for the other animals there?
Yeah, I think what I want to do personally, I mean, I haven't talked to the many, many, many other organizing people that I need to before we make a final decision on strategy, but I think we need to make sure that they respect the ban and that they accept the jurisdiction of the park board. So we're probably going to stay sort of on the cetacean angle for just a little bit until the law is enacted. But there's other stuff we can do. So I think we'll need to be out there and just representing that captivity is harmful and like I said earlier, kind of use this as a template to hopefully disrupt their other activities that are also unfair to animals.
Yeah, unfortunately, when it comes to activism, we do have to work in a sort of baby steps type of a strategy. And I do feel like this was one big step up, and now we can move on to the next one. An example of that, actually, is I spoke with the commissioners after the meeting last night. I actually gave every single one of them a whale hug, and I thanked them for opening their minds and hearts. And then I said, but let's not be
speech. You gave them a what?
I gave them a whale hug. I said whale hugs, and I was hugging them.
A whale hug.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But I said, let's not be speciesist here. This is a win for the cetaceans only, and let's remember that the other animals in there are absolutely suffering just as much. And they nodded and agreed.
Oh, okay.
So that could be the next thing that we are...
Maybe it was the ominous nod of, oh, God, the disruptors are going to start coming to the meeting all the time.
With different t-shirts. Well, thank you so much for all your work. And of course, I know you always want to acknowledge everybody else, but you really have been someone who's been doing a ton of organizing, and you've been...
I couldn't do it without all of you, though, and I couldn't do it without everybody. And can I add something, actually?
Sure.
Okay, so for me, really what's important is for me to, if I am going to gloat at all, it's going to be that protest action, making noise, pressure campaigns, they absolutely do work. They sometimes take a little while to work, but they get things done, and I encourage people to join those actions. I know a lot of times people have mentioned to me that they're shy or they're worried that it's, you know, something dangerous or scary, and honestly, it's just another community of people who feel like you do, and we really need your support and for you to join. And that's across the board, not just with animal rights activism, but where it intersects with humanist focuses and all sorts of other things. Reconciliation can benefit the same way we've seen at pipelines. So a lot of these things all interrelate, and I want us all to stand up and be rad like we know we are.
And we are an awesome group, and I'm so happy to be in the presence of people with such big hearts, and you show up with food for everyone, and it's a good time, actually.
Yeah, actually, a lot of them were, even though the content, the subject matter was a little dark, or we were there for, you know, relatively morose reason. Yeah, I had a lot of fun and getting to know people and seeing people's amazing perspectives. That's rewarding as well. So it's not just yelling and chanting and going home. We all do end up forming a community together, and we are stronger for it. So.
Yeah, I don't know what I would do without this community, and I only discovered it 2 years ago. So please join us, and thank you so much, David. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for all you do, everyone.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Great interview. Thank you so much, Jen. And once again, wow, right? This actually happened.
Yeah, I can't feel like it. I'm floating right now.
And thank you for reporting on it, too. I know you did this all last minute because this happened last night.
Yeah.
So thanks for all your hard work. You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, March the 17th. It's going to be our annual show for Meet Out Day, which happens annually on March the 20th. So once again, again, we'll be having our annual interview with Paul Shapiro. He's the Vice President of Farmed Animal Agriculture Issues at the Humane Society of the United States. He'll be speaking with us about the latest trends in the meat industry and consumption of meat and consumption of vegan foods. And looking forward to that. We'll also be having a good discussion about just our advice and tips on eating vegan and what we like to eat. So we here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream the shows or download the shows as podcasts. You can read our show blog there with detailed links and also subscribe to the show via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And if you have any comments or suggestions about the show, you can either send us a message on Facebook or email us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And Jen, you wanted to announce the song for today.
Yes, in honor of last night's victory at the Vancouver Park Board and dedicated to all the hardworking activists who helped obtain this goal. I love you all. You make my heart want to explode. Thank you so much for your passionate efforts. We're not done. And this song is for you. It's called We Are the Champions by Queen. Enjoy.
Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.
I've paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime. And bad mistakes I've made a few. I've had my shells and kicked in my. It's been no bed of roses.